Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help the military community in their transition and succeeding in a civilian career. Today's episode number 305 with Lieutenant General Ben Freakley.
So the first thing I would say was there's an element of fear because all of us are going from the known. The crazy thing about the military is when we join, all of a sudden we know what clothes to wear, we know what time to get up, we know what we're going to do all day, we know we're going to go to our next school, we know we should be considered for promotion, we know if we make promotion, hallelujah, if we don't make promotion, that tells us something else. But there's a map in front of us, there's a roadmap, regardless of whether I'm a young sailor or whether I'm a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps or I'm a senior airman, there's a map in front of us. And so now we go from the known to the unknown, and there's a bit of fear.
Well, I have to say, first of all, interviewing a three-star general, that being 10 years out of the military, I think my respect for someone in that position has only increased over time. At the Naval Academy, we would see flag officers on campus, and the main feeling I had was just one of avoidance. You know, it felt like an ant not wanting to be crushed by an elephant. And I think in the military, sometimes I got jaded and started thinking like, well, if I stay in, you know, you just get promoted at certain levels and you just, you know, wait your time and stay in and you'll make it to the top. And I think that in the 10 years since, I just see that, you know, being CEO of a Fortune 1000 company or being a rank of admiral or general, each of those, it's just unbelievably difficult to achieve that level. And just the skill set required to continually adapt one's leadership and then manage just a massive organization like that is still mind-boggling to me. So it was such a treat and honor to meet with Benjamin today and to hear about the lessons he learned in the military, but also learn what it's like to transition at such a senior rank after over 30 years of military service into in this case, leading at an incredible organization like Arizona State University, as well as the John McCain Institute for International Leadership. I think there's a lot about leadership here. It's a lot about curiosity, about realism in the transition, about supporting the community. There's a lot of great information about ASU in this as well. I had brief time with Benjamin, and I wanted to use that time as much as possible to hear from him, and I hope to have him back on the show. So I wasn't able to read the bio at the start of our interview, and I wasn't able to interject as much as I normally do. So if you stick around after this episode, I'll go through a few minutes of discussion of what stood out to me in case that's helpful, maybe reinforcing some of the points from this interview. But let me give you his bio. Lieutenant General Benjamin Freakley is the Special Advisor to the President for Leadership Initiatives at Arizona State University. Additionally, he serves at the McCain Institute for International Leadership at Arizona State University. He recently retired from the U.S. Army recently as in 7 years ago, after more than 36 years of active military service, and was serving as Commanding General of U.S. Army Accessions Command at the time of his retirement. He started out at West Point. As you'll see in this conversation, that is just barely scratching the surface of his experience, and I hope you enjoy this one. As always, at beyondtheuniform.org, you will find show notes with links to everything we discuss, a couple great YouTube videos where he's talking about different topics, and you'll also find over 300 episodes just like this one. You'll also find we have our new Beyond the Uniform swag section. If you want to get a hat, t-shirt, polo shirt, or sticker, we're selling those at cost. We don't make a penny. At cost to members of the military and veterans, or if you want to donate additional, there's an option for that as well. Or if you're not part of the military, we charge a couple bucks more. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Ben. Well, joining me today in Arlington, Virginia, my guest is Lieutenant General Benjamin Freakley. Ben, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Justin.
And for listeners, I just want to give a call out. Special thanks to John Fenzel from episode 199. John, a man I greatly respect, said of Ben that he is one of the best leaders I've ever known. And when you get that sort of endorsement from someone like John, I'm eager to connect with the person. So, Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, you're welcome. That's high praise from a superb leader, John Fenzel.
I agree. Well, maybe to start things off, I'm excited to learn about, you have led the 10th Mountain Division in Afghanistan, and I'm wondering if there's any lessons learned from that leadership experience that you'd like to share.
Well, we'd need about 8 podcasts to fill up all the learning I did in that experience. But first, I was very honored to have the opportunity to lead the women and men of United States Armed Forces. It was the 10th Mountain Division, was the core of what's called a joint task force. It was Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, and a lot of our great interagency partners, FBI, CIA, Department of Agriculture, United States Agency for Internal Development, just a magnificent team of Americans who were trying to do great work and change the environment for the Afghans. I guess my one huge leader lesson would be patience. When you lead at that level and you lead a complex organization that also included international forces from primarily NATO and the Afghans themselves, you need a lot of patience. You need to really understand where the people are coming from and what their limitations and what their capabilities are. I think the other big takeaway for me would be that leaders need to understand the culture, the environment they're leading in. That goes from a teacher who's in the fourth grade and is going to change and now start teaching in the ninth grade, to a banker who's leaving the for-profit and moves to a nonprofit. It's important as we move around as leaders to really understand the culture that we're leading in. But those would be my two biggest, is probably patience and understanding the culture where you are.
That's great. I've been out of the military now for about 10 years, and I think my maybe appreciation and respect for leading at that level and the coordination that must be required to have all of these different organizations and all of the people underneath them headed in one direction. It's just very difficult for me to get my head around at this point, just the sheer challenge involved. So I love that thought of understanding the organization and that empathy for the people that you're leading.
Yeah, and I think, you know, at that level, that part of that patience is leaders at very senior levels have to establish a vision, and they have to empower and delegate and trust that all those folks beneath them are going to, consistent with that vision, move forward and accomplish the aims. If you think with that many people, you know, 18,000 just from the 10th, and then yet on top of that, we were knocking on the door 25,000, 26,000 people. If you think you can get into every nuance of leadership, that's really naive. And so it's so important just to reiterate your vision, reinforce the values of America, who we stand for in person, and our service values, and then also to delegate, and just trust the team to take care of it. And it's amazing what you see people do. I mean, I walked away from seeing 19-year-olds in the battlefield, and I turned to my aide and say, I'm just not worthy to lead these guys, because they were just so incredible as young men and women out on that battlefield.
That kind of just brings up a question in the moment. And just for context, I left the Navy when I was an 03, a lieutenant. And at the time, I was just looking and marveling at how my bosses, lieutenant commanders, 04s, how the skill set required to succeed was completely different than the skill set I needed to succeed. And they needed to delegate, they couldn't be an individual contributor anymore. And so when I view someone like yours military career, the question that baffles me is like, man, you must have had to reinvent your leadership style every 2 or 3 years. I just imagine as you kept on getting promoted, what worked for you in the past was not going to work for you in the present. And I'm curious, you know, how you approach that, how you continue to learn and evolve as a leader. I think it's really remarkable.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm not in a special case. There's a lot of great people at all levels doing that. One of the things that helps is this idea in our military talks about is direct versus indirect leadership. So when you're a young non-commissioned officer, when you're a young officer in any service, it's direct leadership. Follow me, do as I do. You know, in the Army, we talk about be, no, do. You know, be an authentic leader, know your job, and do, lead by example. So that direct leadership is very, very much hands-on, by example, with the team, in the trenches, either learning from them or showing them what to do. As you get, up to the lieutenant colonel, commander level in the Navy, it starts to become sort of you're standing on the fence post between direct and indirect leadership. And clearly by the time you're a Navy captain or Army colonel or Marine colonel, you are now in indirect leadership mode, and you've got to delegate to others. You've got to sort of be President Reagan, trust but verify. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you got to go down and check the boys down in the propulsion unit on the ship, but a lot of time you're still up in the command and control center commanding the ship. So it is an art form, and you're exactly right. I think style changes. You know, if you go into an organization that needs a lot of discipline, that needs a lot of reinforcement of values in the way forward, there's a lot of more of a hands-on and maybe very directed leadership style. As you take on a mature organization like our Joint Task Force was in Afghanistan, working with these incredible professionals from the CIA, the Navy, the Marines, the Army, there's a lot more, hey guys, how do you think we ought to do this? Sort of consensus leadership. Point them in a direction, solicit their ideas, listen, then make a decision and execute violently. But it is an art, and you're exactly right. And it's a great leadership point about you have to adapt your style to where the environment you're leading in. You're exactly right.
Hmm. One other just kind of spur of the moment question with that is, given your incredible leadership experience in the military and now, you know, 7+ years leading outside of the military, have there been any surprises or any thoughts about things that you needed to change, or how is there any difference in leadership now that you're outside versus when you were in?
Well, absolutely. I mean, first of all, I had this wonderful opportunity to serve at Arizona State University and in the McCain Institute for International Leadership, which is a part of our university. And anybody who thinks that they can go into higher education with all these incredible professors and researchers and bright minds and say, hey, we're all going to do this right now, you're out of your mind. It's really very much consensus leadership. And it takes a lot more time. You kind of introduce a notion maybe in week one, and maybe in week two you say, what do you guys think? And in week three you say, you still with me on this? And then week four you kind of get going on it. But the old walk out on the deck of the ship and say, right, we're going to make a left turn here with the ship, get on this bearing, and everybody get to battle stations. That doesn't happen with higher education. It's a mutual respect. It's a mutual understanding that everybody in the room brings incredible talents and gifts to the table, and it's trying to get the most out of everybody to move in the direction that they need to move to in America's biggest nonprofit public university. But it's a blast. It's a challenge, but it's a blast because you're around such talented people. And for me, I'm around young people, and I like being around young people as an older guy.
That's awesome. I also wanted to ask, you took over the Army's Accessions Command at a time when the Army was not meeting its recruiting mission. How do you climb that nearly vertical learning curve quickly and then lead out of that kind of crisis?
Well, you go to the troops a lot. The first year I came out of Afghanistan in February after 13 months, and in May I took command of Accessions Command. I had never been an Army recruiter. Thankfully, I had command in Fort Benning, Georgia, and knew the role of the drill sergeant. Army Accessions Command, for the listeners that don't kind of remember it or know much about it, the idea was from first handshake to first unit of assignment. So meeting the civilian on the streets of America or on our college campuses, both with soldier recruiting and with officer recruiting and development, all the way through initial military training, where they got trained at, you know, Fort Benning or Fort Sill, Oklahoma, or Fort Huachuca, Arizona, that initial training till they joined their unit. So for me, you're exactly right, incredible learning curve. So after that 13 months, first year as an Accessions Command, I traveled over 200 days.
Wow.
And I went to, so my battle rhythm, if you will, was, I'd go to Dallas, Texas, And in Dallas, I would go to a high school where we had 1,683 high schools with 300,000 young men and women in junior ROTC, which is a civics program. And by law, you can't recruit from it. But I just go to see how we were executing that civics program to those young men and women in those 1,683 programs. And then in Dallas, I'd go to a university like Southern Methodist University, and I'd look at the ROTC program, and I'd see what they were doing with developing officers. But my real learning curve was going to recruiting stations and talking to the Sergeant First Class, that E7 that runs those recruiting stations, and talking to their battalion sergeants majors, these permanent recruiters, these professional recruiters, and say, how you doing? How are you doing it? What do you need? You know, at that level, my job was to resource the field. Mm. Give them the right number of recruiters, give them the right kind of money for marketing and advertising. We're doing the Army Strong campaign to work with John Finzel and his brigade, which had the best parachuters, best marksmen, best exhibitors in the Army, to sort of figure out where to send those assets at the right place to tell the Army story, to raise the level of awareness in a community, complex, but learn from the streets. And having seen these recruiters talk to me about best practices, you know, African-American female recruiter in Chicago who says, hey, sir, I'm successful because I go into the family's living room and I recruit in front of the whole family. So I don't keep the grandmother or the mother or anybody out of the loop. The whole family's involved and they feel like it's transparent and they have a say. And you just find those bright leaders out there and then you try to replicate it across the command and encourage people to get out and get after it. Knowledge that it's hard work. A lot of people have no idea the hours that our recruiters put in, the hours that our drill sergeants put in to build the Army or our Navy or our Marines or our Air Force. I mean, the institutional side and the devotion and the sacrifice and the work that our college professors and our recruiters and our drill sergeants do is really misunderstood, but it's unbelievable the sacrifices they and their family make to, what I say, build the Army. I used to say to the team, you guys are creating the United States Army in a time of war. Mm. Other people are leading them, but you're creating them. And it was just listening to the team and trying to learn best practice and learn as fast as I could.
I appreciate that too, because I just feel like for listeners, regardless of, you know, especially the ones who are already veterans and out of the military, the principles that you're describing there feel very translatable to every industry, every functional role, that aspect of the FaceTime and supporting people. And I remember at the Naval Academy, we went to the Jet Stadium and the guy that ran it was a veteran. And I just remember him, like, he was taking us around and every person on the ground, he knew their name. He was like, hey, I got the walkie-talkie you wanted. And that's what comes through to me when you're talking of just like, getting in front of your team and seeing how you can support them in this servant leadership model that I think no matter what someone ends up doing in uniform or out, that's just such a great foundation.
Well, you're exactly right. And, you know, one thing our listeners can take great stock in, I would just say one thing to them, and is if you don't know your hometown recruiter, Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine, shame on you. Mm. You should go know them and help them build our military. But on the other side, yes, one of the most easy transferable skills for a veteran is their number one knowledge of what service truly is. They really know, regardless of service, how to put others before self. You know, the old shipmate sailor is the best way to put it, you know. And but the Army's value of selfless service, of putting others before self, is so translatable and so rapidly recognized by for-profit, nonprofit, cross-sector leaders. They pick up on that right away. They're astounded that someone's at their desk past the work hours and they're saying, what are you doing? Well, it's my duty to get this report in, or I've got to talk to this guy in the field, or I've got to get this requisition or this supply slip filled out so these guys can get what they need. Some people are like surprised by that. Mm. But they're looking at that skill set as a profession, not as a job. And they're giving something to it. They're bringing that selfless service. But I think the other thing is that raw, direct leadership of knowing your team, you know, just ask them, hey, how's your wife doing? How's your daughter doing? Hey, how's your mom and dad? What's up? That's such a skill that's learned in the military, but not in the civilian workforce. Mm-hmm. And you see it all the time. And you're exactly right. And it's something that they can really anchor to. They may not know everything that Intel Corporation needs them to bring. They may not be an expert, but they understand teamwork, leadership, loyalty, selflessness, they understand that. And it's a real bankable skill set that our veterans have.
That's great. I also wanted to ask, and this is directly related, we got feedback from our audience where they said, hey, we'd love to hear more transition stories from 05s and above. We're going well above 05 with your own transition story. But I know it's nearly 8 years ago. I'm just curious what your transition was like and any advice you'd like to share with people who may be at that 05 and above level about how to approach the transition.
Sure. Well, for the first thing, you know, here's a guy that went to West Point when he was 17 years old, and he's now 59. No idea of where it went, but it was a joyous ride. Incredible people. It was the people, the soldiers and their families. So the first thing I would say was there's an element of fear because all of us are going from the known. The crazy thing about the military is when we join, all of a sudden we know what clothes to wear. We know what time to get up. We know what we're going to do all day. We know we're going to go to our next school. We know we should be considered for promotion. We know if we make promotion, hallelujah. If we don't make promotion, that tells us something else. But there's a map in front of us. There's a roadmap, regardless of whether I'm a young sailor or whether I'm a Lance Corporal of the Marine Corps or I'm a senior airman, there's a map in front of us. And so now we go from the known to the unknown, and there's a bit of fear. And, you know, I'm 59 years old. Do people want to hire me? I mean, why me? I'm an old guy going to the workforce. What field? Where should I go? You know, I had one general say to me, you exactly have to know what you're going to do when you leave the military. I would argue with that a little bit. I don't know that you need to be locked in so hard that you can say, I'm going to go work for DuPont Chemical and nobody else. And if they don't hire me, I guess I'll be homeless. You've got to be agile and you've got to be adaptive. So one thing was fear. The second thing I would say is preparation. I spent the last 18 months before I left active duty, knowing that I was going to leave active duty, asking young non-commissioned officers, warrant officers, command sergeant majors, colonels, generals. I asked them, what is your transition story? Tell me how you transitioned. What did you do? How did you do it? And you have to prepare yourself mentally that I'm going to leave. And then, you know, there's the triangle they always talk about. Where do you live? How happy are you in your work? And how much do you make? And you want to try to balance those three points of the triangle with you in the middle. And some people make a lot of money, but they don't really like their work. And some people live where they want to live, but they don't like their work and they don't like their money. And some people get all three. And that's where you have to have a dialogue with your family. And, you know, you have to kind of set priorities with your family about what's the most important. And I know a general officer, most important for them was to live where his wife wanted to live. And that limited him in job opportunities. But the first priority was where they lived. But I think you have to think about those things in parallel. So I was thinking about that. I had some very good mentors who wanted to set me up in defense and work in defense. And I was open enough to go to a few interviews and looked into it. But I got to tell you, I kept thinking, no, I want a new adventure. I want to do something I've never done before. I used to have this saying on active duty, both in combat and out of combat, that if you feel comfortable where you are, it's time to move. In combat, if you're comfortable where you are, you're going to get attacked. In life, if you're comfortable where you are, you don't grow as a leader. You don't get that curiosity spark leaves you and you get complacent. You think, I've been there, done that. I know everything. And you become the cranky old guy that knows everything about supply. But you don't know everything else. So I think you've got to be adaptive. And so the more I kind of interviewed and talked to people about defense, the more I didn't want to do it. And I had had this wonderful opportunity at Sessions Command to learn more about education, both junior high or high school with the junior ROTC program and with higher education with senior ROTC. We had 37,000 students in almost 1,200 universities. Through Army ROTC, and by luck, by sheer luck, I got to meet Dr. Crow at ASU, and he started talking to me about his vision for Arizona State University. And imagine a vision that includes we'll be known not who we exclude, but who we include and how they succeed. And that sounded an awful lot like our military to me, that we welcome all races, all creeds, all colors, all genders. We welcome them all. and we turn them into a team. And I just thought, now that's something I could be a part of. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it was alignment of my values to the organizational values of Arizona State. And then, and one of the sticking points was, you know, he said, why won't you close the deal? Because he talked to me for like 4 months. And I said, well, Dr. Kerr, I really don't want to live in Arizona. I'm an East Coast guy. I've got five sons. We live in the East Coast. He said, look, I don't care where you live. I just want you to be part of our team. And so with a leader like that, you know, sometimes we put our own mental blocks up that to work for Intel Corporation, we have to work in Phoenix. They might let us telecommute. They might fly us in every month. We can strike those deals, but we don't, because in the military, when they say, hey, you're moving from Fort Bragg, North Carolina to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, it's yes, sir. You don't work a deal. In transition, you can work the deal. And that's one of the things I really learned. So I think for my transition story, don't be afraid. You will get hired. Easy to say, but when you live in it, you have some intimidation. Even three-star generals are intimidated about what's going to happen. Can I take care of my family? Am I going to make a living? Can I do something worthwhile? Don't be afraid. Be open to ideas. Be curious and don't do something that's easy. Do something that starts a new adventure. And have some realism. I was talking to a wounded warrior before he separated when I was at Fort Knox. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, sir, I'm going to open a small gun shop. He says, wonderful. That's a great thing. And do you know a lot about guns? Oh, yes, sir. I grew up, know a lot about guns, know a lot about hunting, fixing guns, everything like that. I said, how about your small business? What do you know about small business? Hey, sir, I don't know anything about small business. I said, have you thought about going to community college and learning about small business? Have you thought about finding a business mentor and go apprentice for 2 years before you put your hard-earned money into a gun shop? What about, I'm from rural Shenandoah County, Virginia. I said, what about open an archery so your clientele's a little bit broader? He said, well, I don't know anything about archery. So I said, so go find hire somebody else that does. But don't just be a gun shop, be a gun archery, you know, sell clothes, but you might want to get a little experience. And the other thing is on expectation. You know, I had a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful sergeant first class. And I said, what are you going to do? He said, I don't know, sir, but whatever I do, I'm making $90,000. I said, wow, how are you going to do that? You got a job? He said, no, but with my experience in the Army, I'm going to set up right at $90,000 to get in the force. I'm like, you know, brother, you might want to be a little more open. You might find someplace right next door that you love with great people who share your values. And what if it's only 65? You're going to say no? And they'll recognize your worth and they'll fleet you up. But sometimes we set unrealistic hurdles in front of ourselves and then we don't sell ourselves to the workforce. And then the other thing is just, you know, the first thing I dropped was general, sir, and needing anything. You know, even at ASU, they said, well, do you want an executive assistant? I said, no, let me get going. Let me demonstrate that I can bring something to the university. I don't want a lot of support. Let me contribute. Because I was told that some people think that generals to take a job need a lot of support around them to get the job done. And you do get a lot of support on active duty, but you're not going to get it on the other side. So a little humility and a little figuring out and stepping back to rolling up your sleeves and getting it done helps a lot.
I love it. And listeners know I usually like to comment after statements. There's so much there to unpack. And stick around after this episode. I'm going to kind of reiterate some of these points because Ben just left so many gems in what he just said. And I don't want to take up the time here, but I'll do that after the episode. I want to make sure we talk about your work at Arizona State University, where you work for the president on all of the leadership initiatives, as well as the McCain Institute. And maybe just to simplify this, if you were talking to someone on active duty who asked you what you do for a living, how would you explain those organizations and what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. So first of all, at Arizona State University, I work at the most dynamic, inclusive, innovative, entrepreneurial, forward-thinking, nonprofit public university in America. Mm-hmm. With 80,000 students online and 50,000 students, 80,000 students on campus and 50,000 students online, including 8,900 veterans, and every one of them count as an individual, and every one of them are incredibly important to every one of us. Because our whole thinking, guided by our president, Michael Crow, is, again, will be known not by who we exclude, but who we include and how they succeed. Because you see, today in the 21st century, the knowledge era, our higher education has it wrong in describing themselves as being exclusive. We're the Naval Academy. We only let in 10%. Same with West Point Air Force. We're William & Mary. We only let in 8%. We're Harvard. We only let in 7%. In the knowledge era, we need 40% of America's workforce to have a college degree so they can innovate and create work for the rest of America. Everybody doesn't need a college degree. Thank God there's guys that can repair mufflers. Thank God there's guys that can wire electricity in your home. Thank God that there's x-ray technicians that can hook you up when you're not feeling well. But we do need an educated population. And when our colleges should be opening the doors and bringing in Americans and internationals, we're not doing that, but we are at Arizona State. So one part of my work is I'm an advisor to Dr. Crow on leadership initiatives, which is just a big title for doing the work that he and I together think needs to be done. But one of the things you can imagine, there was a lot of military activity at Arizona State, and our team was able to bring that together in what we call the Military Affairs Council. So whether it's active duty officers getting an advanced degree, or it's our veterans getting a degree, or it's research, military research, or it's working with military entities like Fort Huachuca, Luke Air Force Base, and others, we bring all that family together for collaboration and coordination, not command and control, not trying to tell them how to do their research or how to train veterans or educate veterans. We're trying to keep each other aware and do the best things we can to advance the work. So for instance, an online veteran, Department of Defense wants a veteran to pay $220 for a credit hour. Our credit hours cost more than that because we have full professors that teach online. We don't use instructors. So we have a scholarship. Our veterans pay $220. We make up the rest of it with a scholarship from ASU where we pay the professor the full rate, but our veteran only pays what the GI Bill allows for, no penalty to the veteran. That's one thing we've worked through. Another thing we work through, you know, our online veterans, sometimes they're on a ship. And true story, in Seattle, and the ship's in rebuild. So they're fully capable of being online. All of a sudden, the ship goes out for sea trials after workup, and they're not online for a while. So do you drop them for the class? Do you give them an incomplete because they're not online? No, you understand that they're on a field training exercise, or they're deployed, or they're in a ship workup, and you tell them, okay, when you can come back, you come back, you complete the requirements, you get your grade, you complete your course, no cost, no extra cost. You're still an active learner, an active student. We started, because of my time in Afghanistan and grappling with the lack of trust between State Department, DOD, USAID, a lot of friction on these provincial reconstruction teams. Hey, you military guys have everything. You have Humvees, you have HF radios, you have IED jammers, you got everything. We don't have anything. You get this friction and there's a lack of trust. So we started the one-of-a-kind Arizona State University Public Service Academy. And from having nothing, based on like a service academy like the Naval Academy, we bring in men and women, full scholarship. We teach them cross-sector leadership, public, private, nonprofit, to go forward and selflessly serve in those sectors other than military. But they train with, we have 650 Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, ROTC students at Arizona State. So they train together. So the military guys understand the mindset of the folks that want to be nonprofit, and the nonprofit guys understand the military mindset. And hopefully, heaven forbid, 20 years from now, some Navy captain shows up where a tsunami is hit and there's a USAID rep there, and they both graduated from a public service academy, and they immediately have trust. They have a common shared experience because what they experienced together. We want to prototype a public service academy at Arizona State, and then other universities pick it up and do it as well. We had our first graduating class last year, and you know, to get into Teach for America, to get into AmeriCorps, Peace Corps, Bloomberg Philanthropies, that's tough cuts to get in that. We flooded the market with our first graduates because they have to do an internship every summer, in one summer nonprofit, one summer for-profit, one summer public. So they've had experience in the sectors. They've had leadership training in the sectors. They've got a solid degree in whatever they want it to be in, physics, philosophy, poetry, you name it. But they're well-educated. They're leader-trained, and it's exciting to see this. So we went from nothing. Imagine having no upper class when you're a freshman. That's good and bad. To where you become the upper class, and we've had our first cohort graduate. Very exciting. So that's some of the work at Arizona State. Besides, we constituted a Flag Officer Advisory Council. Dr. Crow said, you know, these generals and admirals at the zenith of their career, when the military is invested in them, they tell them to retire. They're just getting going. He said, there's no way I'd let a 59-year-old professor go when they've got so much more runway to keep working. So we have 18 women and men from all services, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine, Coast Guard, who are the Flag Officer Advisory Council and advise Dr. Crow and other parts of the university on how to do better work and network with the military. I'll take a breather for you to ask me a question about ASU, but then I can move on to McCain Institute.
No, I think this is great, and I love the energy, and I love the amount that you're doing, and I especially appreciate how you're accommodating veterans as part of that inclusion and making sure that everything is accessible, and just the sheer magnitude of the vision of rolling these programs out. And I'd love to hear about the McCain Institute.
Yeah, I will just mention one other thing that I should mention. Run by a former Navy captain, mm-hmm. we have the Pat Tillman's Veterans Center at ASU. And it's just such a wonderful model. In fact, I brought other leaders to it because what it is, it's a one-stop shop for our veterans. To begin, you know, that transition from I'm in the Marines and now I'm going to become a college student. You know, what we talk about these transitions, first I have to decide I'm going to go to college. Then secondly, I have to apply and get in. Then thirdly, I've got to get back to being a good student because it might have been some years since I wrote research papers or I did mathematics or I did a lot of intense study. And then I've got to see my way to graduation because I might have a family and I'm trying to balance some work and my education and taking care of my family. And sometimes what goes first is the education. And then I've got to see myself to graduation. And that last transition is graduating from college to meaningful work. So we feel like we owe it to our veterans to help with every one of those transitions. The Pat Tillman Center smoothed that because we have the VA and our higher education in one center, named after a legendary ASU Sun Devil and a man who gave his last full measure of devotion to our country, Ranger Pat Tillman in Afghanistan, gave up a Arizona Cardinals football salary to come be a soldier, a ranger. But there in our center, you can find out about your GI Bill, your healthcare benefits, your housing benefits, everything the VA has for you. And then you can find your map for your higher education. And we even have a veteran advocate who is a veteran. So if a veteran needs to take chemistry 202 to stay on track with the GI Bill and the class is filled, our advocate will call that professor and say, hey, he's got to get this done to stay on track, put him in your class, and they put him in the class. So we have advocacy, information, and awareness, and other veterans to help you all in one center. Now, the McCain Institute for International Leadership, a part of ASU, after the legacy of Senator John McCain, another veteran, and selfless service to country, serving causes greater than self. And our mission at the McCain Institute is to advance democracy, freedom, human rights, economic equality, rule of law, and countering human trafficking. So my role there is to run an international leaders program where we bring in 10 to 12 mid-level leaders every year for a year-long leader development course in character-driven leadership, the commitment to do the right thing in the right way for the right reasons in their home country. And they're selected based on what they're going to do to have impact in their country after they finish a year of leader development with us. And it's open to anybody. They can apply online at the McCain Institute, which is online. I just put in McCain Institute. We have tried to have an American per year. This year we had a Native American from the Navajo Nation, a police detective who's countering human trafficking in the Indian nations. Mm-hmm. She's an unbelievable leader. And so we welcome men to this great program. We pay a stipend. Everything's paid for. So you can focus a year of where are you now? Where do you want to go? And how are you going to make impact in America, or how are you going to have impact abroad? Many of them are countering, they're doing women's empowerment in countries. They're fighting corruption in countries. They're running for political office. We have a Venezuelan who stands for free speech in the Maduro oppressive regime. And he's out every night putting his life on the line, filming and speaking out against the Maduro regime and the suppression of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. They're incredible, brave people making a difference globally. We've now trained 62 from 44 countries. And we have a train-the-trainer program for them, and they have to train 100 people per year. So we're going to scale through that program and training thousands of men and women in the image of Senator McCain, Navy fighter pilot, prisoner of war, congressman, senator, a life of service to our country. And it's exciting to work there just because of the work we do and the people we have working there.
That's exceptional. I know we've only got about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I always just like to leave space at the end. I know we didn't get a chance to talk about the Decision Theater or the Gettysburg National Military Park, but I want to leave you with the last 3 or 4 minutes here to share whatever is on your heart, whatever you want to make sure listeners know.
Well, I would encourage you, if you want to know about the Decision Theater, to get online and look at it. But basically, it's a wonderful initiative at ASU started by Dr. Crow on how to take big data and technology and help leaders make better decisions by visualizing data. Mm-hmm. It's all about data visualization. Imagine a round room with 7 huge computer monitors in it that you put models on, and those models interact as you change variables and you can look at different outcomes. Hmm. We have all kinds of great people we've worked with and for, from Adidas to municipalities in Arizona to folks who are fighting smallpox to folks who are looking at sustaining water in the Southwest. A great portfolio. We're just a tool for great research to come to us, but really what I would like to leave with is that our number one, I'm so proud of the men and women currently serving in uniform. I have a son wearing that uniform right now in Afghanistan right now. But also the families that make such a sacrifice so that we can serve. And the families that, you know, it's so hard for our families because most of America doesn't realize we're in the conflicts we're in right now globally, and especially where our special operations forces are and many of our National Guard, Reserve, and Special Forces folks are deployed in penny packets around the globe, helping even the Marines standing guard at embassies globally. We don't think about those guys until we read about them, and we ought to be on our knees every night thinking that they're standing watch so we can have our freedoms. But the other thing to our veteran listeners, I would just say take heart. You've got everybody who's pulling for you. Get connected in your communities and know who the different veterans organizations are and the people that are servicing veterans. Get out there and look for a hand up. Please don't look for a handout because you're better than that, but look for those hand ups because all of us will give you a hand up. If you need, you know, I'm on LinkedIn. If you want me to help you figure out the higher education space, jump on it and I'll help. Just take stock instead of complaining that there's nothing for me out there. In this war since 2011, 2001, a lot has come out, and look for the better organizations and seek their help. You know, President Bush's Institute has a whole part of it that's dedicated to helping veterans. President Obama, Ms. Obama started joining forces and have different organizations that have signed up to help veterans. But again, the veteran's got to look for his or her fit. But take heart. America stands behind you and with you as veterans, and there is a place for you. You just, sometimes it takes a little time and a little agility, but there is a lot beyond the uniform for each and every one of you. Mm.
Well, General, thank you so much for your time. I feel like the amount of wisdom that you were able to share in just a short time is exceptional. And I think that this is one of those episodes that warrants a second listen for people just to soak in all of the extensive experience both in and out of the military that you have and how you blend those two. So thank you. And I know there's probably no shortage of demands on your time, but I appreciate your making space for us today.
No, you're very welcome. And I'm very proud of you guys and what you're doing to spread a greater awareness and help our veterans move away from suicidal thoughts to hopeful thoughts and a great bright future in front of them. And that's what you guys are doing. I'm proud of you and thankful to you for doing it.
Surface.
Well, thank you so much for listening. Normally during these interviews, I like to chime in and break up the pace, try to tease out some lessons learned or just share what's resonating with me. With Ben, I just felt like he had so much to offer and we had limited time. And so I didn't want to interject and take away from hearing as much of his knowledge and wisdom as possible. But I was just taking notes and wanted to walk through and highlight at least a few of the things that stood out to me. And feel free to add in the comments for the show notes anything that stood out to you as well. So one of the things that I really liked, first of all, was Ben's honesty around the fear that he experienced when he was approaching his transition. And for me, that really made me relax. It made me feel a little bit more at ease because I think my assumption was that someone, you know, a three-star general, someone like that, well, they've got this in the bag, they know what they're going to do. But to hear even at that level, that uncertainty and that fear, it really normalizes the experience for me. And so I hope for especially those of you who are still in active duty listening to that, that gives you a boost of confidence that you're not alone in this, you're not isolated, that everyone, even the most high-ranking people in our military, approach that transition with some trepidation. And the other piece of that that I just loved was how he talked about how he was going up to chief petty officers, he's going up to everyone who's made the transition, and learning from them. And I think that speaks a lot to his humility. Again, I think that if I was in his shoes, maybe I would just look to other generals or other, you know, people of that rank. And the fact that he realized that everyone experiences this transition and he can learn from anyone really speaks volume about his character. I loved the sense that I got from him around curiosity, around learning something new. And this, yet again, flies in opposition to some of my assumptions going into this. I thought, you know, someone had spent over 30 years in the military, they're just going to coast on that. They're going to continue to do what they were doing. And what I appreciate about his work, both at the McCain Institute as well as at Arizona State University, is his continuous learning. And it stands out that sense of him not even getting an assistant and just wanting to do things, not wanting to be catered to. And I think that's a great attitude, especially if you're not a three-star general, that you can adopt that mindset of learning and being willing to roll up your sleeves even after a very full career in the military. He talked about realism. I think that's great too. He gave that example of someone who said, I just want to make $90,000 when I get out. And I think that does shortchange you. It shortchanges you of all the different levers and factors that play into job satisfaction, location, the connection with people at work, the size of the company, the functional role, the industry, all of these softer factors that are outside of a numeric paycheck. And it also limits you from, you know, you may need to take a step back to find that dream career. It may be something completely unrelated to what you did in the military. And fixating on that salary can really limit your ability to explore and find something that's a good fit for you. I think it was also interesting to see at Arizona State University some of the examples he was giving about the amount of support they provide veterans. And I think that's something to consider whether you are looking at an educational institution excuse me, or whether you are looking at a company to look at how they support the military veteran community. And why I think that's important is not necessarily the support, but I think it speaks to the culture of those organizations. And I know from all of these interviews that many times veterans, and I feel the same way, many times veterans, when they make that transition, they miss the community. They miss that sense of connection to others who have served. And having an organization like ASU where they've got that support in place, it also implies that they've got a strong military community. There's other people there to form community with and connection. And I'm not saying that, you know, obviously when you get out, all of your friends are going to be in the military, My experience wasn't like that, but I had at business school, I had six other vets that I could, you know, connect with when I needed to, which wasn't all the time, but it was really valuable to have that, to have people who understood my background. So those were the main things that stood out to me. Obviously, there's a ton more. I just loved his thoughts on leadership and how it changes outside, and just, again, always learning, always honing one's skill set. But I hope you enjoyed the interview. There's over 300 other ones at beyonduniform.org. Check them out, and thanks to all who make this mission possible. Take care and see you next week.